far are you going?
About 30 years.
In this week's episode,
it's the audio version of the Anime Ego panel at Animazement. Hey guys, it's Dustin from Anime Vestia Podcast. So for this episode, it's actually going to be sort of a special bonus episode since I went to Robert Woodhead's panel at Animazement, and I went ahead and got audio recording for it. The reason why I did audio recording, you may ask, is the fact that I was wanting to do video, but I was in the Trish Ledoux and Toshifumi Yoshida panel trying to videotape that, and Constaff was like, nope, can't do that, gotta stop it. And I kind of saw why, since they both work for the Pokemon Company, and they showed a trailer for the new Pokemon movie or something, so I don't think they wanted that leaked. But I wasn't going to take my chances on that, so I decided to just do an audio recording of Robert's panel, which I promptly and non-timely showed up about 5 or 10 minutes into it. So the audio in this is going to be, you know... Well, let's be honest, the audio isn't that good. I mean, I used my cell phone to record stuff, and I sat near the front. I actually sat next to Phil, who runs Anime Hell, so him and me were asking the hard, you know, straight-up questions to Robert, or the ones that counted. Basically, I say that because the microphone only picked up our voices very well, where it barely picked up the other people's voices. And, you know, basically, it sort of picked up other people's voices, but when I listen to the recording, as you're going to hear, it's hard to tell, and I've had to edit out some stuff, and then I kept Robert's answers in, so it kind of sounds incoherent. I don't know why I did that, I just did, because I figured, like, he'd say something pretty interesting, which all of it is. I had a good time at his panel, I even asked some questions myself, if you can't tell with the voice matching up or whatever. But yeah, you'll be able to hear all that stuff in this recording. I can tell you what I was able to make out on some of those questions. Let's see. There was talk about doing a Kickstarter for Hanzo the Razor movie. And of course, Robert was talking about the Otaku no Video project that's already been funded on Kickstarter. All I'm going to say in this recording now is that yours truly, me, does have a part in working on Otaku no Video. That's all I'm going to say, since I'm under a NDA, or non-disclosure agreement. Public Enemy's number one anti-Twitter, Hazukari, was there asking about Bao. That was one of the questions there. There was, actually, interesting enough, someone did ask and talked about Mina Agechow, or the I Give My All, the anime that was infamously supposed to come out by CPM and supposed to be bundled with panties and never did because, according to that, Sony found out and then were like, nope, don't you dare do that, and you're not going to release that crap. So that was actually mentioned in this panel. Robert talks about his kids going to college and everything. And also Animego's background as a company, which was interesting. Robert talked about working on Wizardry, which is what he was doing during this whole startup of doing anime stuff. Someone also mentioned a question about doing the Wizardry or kickstarting the Wizardry OVA. So you get to hear Robert's answer on that, which was sort of the general answer that everyone agreed with. I think what was one mention of Dan Gaio in translations and Sidekick Wave. The thing is, if you've seen Dan Gaio in the old translation, it's supposed to be Psychic Wave, but they wound up putting Sidekick Wave, and I fully support that, of course. I think I even said that. I said that in this. You'll hear it. Even some people ask about. One person asked about Crusher Joe coming on Blu-ray. Same with Dagger Kamui. And also, Kenichi Sonata is coming out with a new manga about basically doing his own manga about anime fans, which that ought to be interesting. All this is going to be in this recording, so you get to definitely check it out. I do want to say that I know this is a podcast about anime and reviewing anime, which we have not done in a while, but I can assure you that the next episode that comes out will be an anime review, and will be one of our first attempts of covering a review of stuff we were supposed to do and hold up to those commitments of the Indiegogo we did earlier this year that I am now about to put out those episodes. So you'll get to know what the review will be, or that review will be coming out in the next episode. Well, anyways, I've been talking way too long, and I'm going to go ahead and get straight to the panel, so I apologize about the audio, but I think you guys would get a good kick out of it, or maybe kick or something, but I kind of mostly did it for the people on the Anime Ego Facebook group, since a lot of people out there, or at least the ones I know on there, were like, hey, is anybody going to ever, record or videotape your panels? I can't be at such and such con, like Animazement or Otakon, to hear what you have to say and your opinions and stuff. But at least this is kind of like covering what he said at Animazement. So yeah, just enjoy and see you guys in the next episode.
Really cute little things like this, which is, and put more money in the packaging. So our view, the Kickstarter is not so much funding. I mean, you can fund it out of our own pockets, no problem. $40,000 isn't that much money. What I view it as a marketing tool and a risk reduction tool, because if I set the goal at the point where I know that we can make that goal, then it'll be a project that will pay for itself, even at the most minimal level. And if it doesn't make the goal, then at most amount a few thousand dollars of time and expense in setting up the Kickstarter. That's not such a significant concern with a project like Bubblegum Crisis or Takano Video. I'm like 95% sure we're going to make a goal on that. But it will be a much more significant concern in the future, because the things I want to do in the future are much more doing stuff from, say, the 70s and 80s that has never gotten a proper release in the United States. And the reason it's never gotten a proper release is that they're just way too risky when you put them through a normal commercial marketing gauntlet. I mean, it just costs too much money and you just have to risk too much in order to make money. We've been very good over the last 25 years of just barely making enough money to stay in business. We don't want to, screw it up now. So by doing the Kickstarter process, it's basically a marketing tool, and you know that if you make a goal, you're going to be able to do the project and that everybody's going to be happy. And then it's just a matter of, like, based on how many people actually sign up, how fancy of a project you can do. So that sort of generally answers the question. Anybody else? Okay.
I know that you're working on negotiating stuff and you can't tell us about that. Is there anything you've tried to get where you were not able to get it that you can mention specifically?
I won't mention a specific title. There was one title that we were talking about for a long time, but another company snapped it up. So, worst case, you're going to get to see it. So, I can't be, I'm disappointed that it's not going to be us. It was it's a cool thing, cool title that I think a lot of fans have wanted for many, many years. We learned about a month ago that they decided to go a different way, which is fine. That happens all the time.
Sure.
One of the reasons I'm still in business is that there have been many times when I've wanted, really, really wanted to do something, and then another company came in with an offer that was like twice what I was willing to pay for it, and the licensor would say, well, they're offering this much money, and I just basically, if they're offering that much money, take it, but here my advice to you is don't give them the master tapes until you cash the check.
Right.
So that's just the nature of the business. Yep. It's really a mix. The titles that we still have licenses to, those are the easiest ones to do, usually. Not always. Everything is is always much more complicated than you expect. You know, my personal preference, if I have to choose between two things, it's not so much whether we've done it before or not. Is it a title, you know, which title will I enjoy working on the most? Because that's always been our sort of basic filter. You know, first, do we like it? Then, you know, do we think we can make money? Then, can we afford it? If so, we do it, right? And a few times that I sort of not applied that first filter of, because I said, yeah, we can make really a lot of money if we do this. But it's not really my favorite thing. We'll make so much money, you know. They've all been complete disasters. Whenever I don't apply that first, do I like it filter? And my tastes are kind of weird, so oftentimes things that, you know, they're a little bit off the mainstream, but so long as we apply that first filter, we've usually done pretty well. And so we're going to continue to do that. But that said, like I said, there's just so much stuff. I'm sure that each one of you has a favorite, like, old series that never has been released in the United States. Because there's just no way. I'm not privy to what happened internally there, so I really wouldn't want to, you know, make a comment. I will say that one of the advantages that we have is that, you know, we've been around for so long that we've made almost all the mistakes it's possible to make. So we know, and we have the tool set. For us, you know, I can subtitle stuff in my sleep, because I've built a tool set that I've evolved over the last 25 years to do it. Although I really had to upgrade that tool set when we did this Blu-ray set, because we literally broke the authoring system. We found a way to crash the authoring system just by generating subtitles.
That's an achievement.
We found it, and what's worse was that it turned out that there was, in some strange, we found a really strange bug in the authoring system that it would depend on the exact sort of bitmaps in the subtitles that you would get. Every so often you would get a deadly subtitle, it would just kill it dead. But it would die in such a way that you didn't know what that subtitle was.
Oh, jeez. Wow.
Yeah, it was really a nightmare. That's one of the reasons this set was a few months late. We literally spent 2.5 months working through that problem.
On the plus side, a few months late in Kickstarter terms is early.
Yeah, but I would...
Not to suggest bad habits.
Yes, I understand. You know, like... The Otakino Video Project, we're going to promise it by February, and I'm going to try really, really hard to get it out in time for Christmas. Because, you know, I literally have already done about a month's worth of pre-production work even before the Kickstarter started, just because I wanted to get a little bit of a head start. Of course, I thought that I was going to be able to start the Kickstarter about a month ago. So... I've already burned through that little pad time that I have. As of Thursday, we sent off we basically have locked what we think the campaign design is, and we sent it off to Gainax for their review. That may take anywhere from, like, there may be an email waiting for us Monday morning to a couple of weeks. And then we will do any final tweaks we need to do. And so realistically, it'll be like somewhere between early June and mid-June. And we'll just run it for 30 days. And basically, as soon as we hit the goal, we're going to go full into production mode. Obviously, we're not going to wait for the campaign to end.
I agree with that too. Yeah.
Now, I'm not going to rush things to make some arbitrary deadline. If I need to take the final, I'm going to do it. And that's another nice thing about going work directly with the people who are going to buy it, is that I don't have, you know, distributors bringing down my neck saying, you know, you said your street date was going to be this, and, you know, for them, breaking a street date is just like the worst sin imaginable. It feels there's a lot more freedom to doing it this way, which I personally appreciate, you know, because, you know, it frees me from a lot of the restraints of the commercial market, which is why, for example, like, this is the basic version of the bubble and the crisis. And along the way, we added the nice little sleeve and stuff like that. But if you look at it, you notice there's something missing from it, which is it doesn't have any commercial blurbery. It doesn't have barcodes, because I'm never going to sell this in a store. I don't need to do that, so I can concentrate on just doing some nice graphics. And that's something that I actually think is a nice little touch, because barcodes are kind of ugly.
Are you looking at doing non-anime projects as sort of these Kickstarters? I don't know if these sort of overlap between the fans who really wanted Bubblegum Crisis and people who are going, man, I can't wait for that Blu-ray of Hanzo the Razor. I don't know if there's overlap, right? So, you know.
Oh, that was such an insane series.
If you guys haven't seen that one, you're missing out.
I
didn't explain.
That's what I'm going to say.
What series again?
Hanzo the Razor.
Hanzo the Razor.
Exploitation samurai film. Very trashy.
So it's not like Lone Wolf and Cub?
Lone Wolf and Cub is classier in comparison.
Yeah, but
that era.
But same guy.
But the same guy, yes.
Yes.
What
did we call it?
The long arm of the law.
Yeah, no. He was the owner and operator of the longest arm of the law.
Yes, exactly.
Hanzo the Razor is
not to distract the whole pen.
It's not possible to. It's hilarious if you like that kind of thing, but it's not a film series that you can describe in polite company.
No, but back to sort of the question: are there sort of cult samurai titles where you're thinking there might be an audience for this as well?
There are, but I think that the samurai film sort of fandom is kind of more diffuse and less connected. So a lot of what we're trying to do here really depends upon the social connections of fans to let each other know what's going on. It's very much like in the very early days when, you know, apart from, you know, like Animag and a few other sources, so we didn't have the internet, a lot of stuff was word of mouth and personal connections. You know, you usually found out about new stuff because somebody else told you about it. Especially since, you know, not too many video stores carry it, stuff like that. And so that social network is very important. This was before we even knew what a social network really was. And for these kind of crowdfunding Kickstarter projects, it's all about the social network. That's one of the things I learned that I needed to do better on the next project than the Bubblegum Crisis project, was really emphasize getting the backers to let other people in their networks know about it. Which is why we have a whole bunch of cute little social goals in this campaign to kind of like bribe them into like tweeting about it.
Sure.
Once we've established this works a little bit better, then I think there's a possibility for that. It would be the sort of thing not so much for the films, but perhaps for TV series.
Hmm.
Like, Ethel Coleman.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Gosh.
Like, doing a set of, like, you know, 8 or 10 of the best Ethel Coleman episodes. That might be an interesting thing to do this way. I would never be able to do that commercially. The risk would just be too high.
Well, you're hitting a point where if you can cross over sort of the hardcore film fans, because Criterion had such success putting out the like complete Zatoichi box set. But I don't think that crowd who goes out to buy the Criterion stuff is necessarily going, man, I can't wait for the latest Kickstarter. I think you're right, it's sort of different social groups.
Do they get all their...
No, they don't need to.
Criterion is somewhat of a special case.
That's right.
They've been doing a right?
Yes. And it's almost like Criterion fandom is there's like people who collect Criterion, and then there's people who really, really collect Criterion stay in that ecosystem.
Sure.
It's very strange.
Mm. Cult.
Well, I don't mind a cult so long as
I'm not. Yeah.
Well, we're here.
Well, yeah. And I thank you for your support.
Yeah.
This kind of really helps much.
I would not say no. I wouldn't say that it's like the top thing on my list to
do.
But you know, I have great affection for almost everything we've ever released. And a couple of things that we didn't release, but we actually did the work on. If you've ever heard of a show called Mina Agachow? Yeah. That's one of the classic lost animes.
Wait, can you tell us about that one?
Oh, Mina Agachow. Okay. Mina Agachow is this absolutely hilarious softcore anime. It was done in the late 80s, if I recall correctly, and it was licensed by CPM. And CPM was going to do a really big release for it. And this was when CPM was first starting, and they asked us to do the translation and subtitling for it, which we did. And it's a really sweet, hilarious, dirty anime. I mean, I'm not a big fan of porn, and this isn't really porn. It's like hard R kind of thing, you know. Nothing that today's audience would consider outrageous, but for the time, it was a little bit on the 80s sex talk. Yeah. But I do have a soft spot for, like, really funny stuff. And this was really funny. That's why I decided to do it. I mean, we sort of had an informal rule at Animego that we would never do anything that would embarrass my mom. Fortunately, my mom is unbelievably cool. and so, you know, Mina Agachow kind of squeaked in right underneath that line. So we did it, and CPM was all set to release it, but they licensed it from Sony Japan, and when Sony America found out that this was coming out and, you know, it was going to say, you know, produced by Sony Japan, blah, 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 on the packaging, I think the term is they had a conniption. And so it ended up not getting released.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the great lot. I think I've got like a VHS test copy of it somewhere. But a few people still have a copy of it, I'm sure. Yes?
How do you go about deciding what title you're going to like? Do you think, I mean, does it do it?
Sometimes we get asked if we're interested. Most of the time, we just decide, yeah, this is an interesting title. Basically, my wife actually does a lot of the negotiations. My wife's Japanese, so she goes over. We used to live in Japan, which made this a lot easier, but now she goes over a couple times a year, talks to all the licensors. You know, they've got their big books of, you know, what their titles are and stuff like that. We just look at them and say, you know, is this going to be an interesting project to work on? You know, so they start out with a big pile of, like, all this stuff they got, and then it comes a smaller pile of, like, yeah, I wouldn't mind working on that. It might be a fun project. And then it's the smaller pile of, you know, stuff that we think we can make money on and that we think there's a market for. And then the very small pile of, like, stuff that, you know, we can make a deal on for a reasonable amount of money.
Right.
And then... the sort of like the size of those piles varies from time to time. You know, when basically the easiest time for us to license stuff is when the industry has just run off a cliff. The hardest time is when everybody's doing really great, because then the prices go up. And since the stuff we want to do is often, you know, stuff that's not right in the mainstream, but it's off to the side somewhere, you know, when everybody's doing really well, that inflates their costs, and we just look at it and say, well, you know, there's just no way we can make money. It's the same thing when, you know, over the years, there have been tons of titles we've had that we no longer have a license to. It's because when renewal time comes up after 5 years or 7 years or whatever, it's almost like, you know, roll the dice. Well, how's the anime industry doing this year? If it's doing really well, then we know it's going to be really tough to renew, because the renewal fees are going to be very high, and we're just going to look at it and say it's just not going to sell enough to make it work. But on the other hand, if, like, everybody's, you know, all the companies are going bankrupt and people are jumping out of buildings and, you know, Godzilla has just destroyed Tokyo again, then we know we can get a good deal and we can license another project.
So a lot of it's cost.
Well, 25 years of narrowly avoiding bankruptcy. I mean, you have to,
right?
You know, like everyone else, I got a mortgage to pay. Let me put it you this way. I'll just show you the picture. See this adorably cute little cosplayer?
Yeah.
He's in college now.
Oh.
Yeah, so this is how bad we were back in the day.
UNC Wilmington?
I've got one at UNC Wilmington, and I've got another one at Cornell.
Oh, really? Okay, cosplayer over
here. Oh, jeez.
One of those is stupider than the other.
Basically, Cornell is like, you know, their college, you know, their bill is basically how much money do you have? Send it in. Yeah.
Kind of a personal question, but are your kids into anime industry?
No. It's not like they won't watch it, but they're not fans. That's because how can anything that their dad and mom and dad do be cool?
Yeah.
You know? It's also the fact that they've basically grown up in a sausage factory. When you grow up in a sausage factory, the last thing you ever want to eat is sausage, and so that's the way it is with them. I mean, let's see. My eldest is more into gaming. Some computer games, a lot of board games, and RPGs. My youngest is into currently Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and spends a lot. He really enjoys Game of Thrones. So he's been off of college and he hasn't been watching Game of Thrones. So he comes back. You know, he's going to watch it all on HBO Go, and he basically tell me one damn thing about this season, I'm going to kill you. Yeah.
How did viewers want them to the ending?
I was writing computer games, and one of the guys I was writing computer games with was a guy named Ro Adams, who was a huge anime fan. And there was a, we were living in Ithaca, New York. It's after I graduated from Cornell. And we were living there, and the Cornell had an animation club, which was basically people watching like fifth generation VHS tapes, while the one guy in the club who was Japanese was translating in live in real time. And I just got a Color Space 2 video board for my Macintosh 2. This is like 1987, 88, something around it there. And I was this let me put graphics on video, and Ro asked me if I could use it to subtitle some of these anime films so that they could show them at the club. And I thought about it for a minute and said, well, you know, I go over to Japan all the time on business. I could probably go get some licenses. We could sell this stuff, like, on tape. And after we stopped laughing, literally, like, on the floor, can't breathe, laughing at how dumb this idea was, we decided to do it as sort of this weekend fun company. And that's how it all got started.
I know before you got into that story, like you said, computer games, you were the one that created Wizardry?
Yeah.
Are you able to talk about that? Like, how'd you come up with the idea, or what led you into that?
Wizardry was my attempt to put a role-playing game on this little tiny Apple II computer.
Yeah.
It was heavily influenced by earlier games on, like, the Plato system, and, of course, D&D. I was a huge D&D player in college.
Mm-hmm.
I had actually gotten thrown out of college for a year for low grades, messing around with computers too much, and I needed something to do, and I ended up working for a company owned by a business partner of my mother's, doing some business software for him, and then in the spare time, I started writing games, and out of that, you know, couple of games, and eventually Wizardry came, and, you know, it's just one of those silly things, right place, right time, mm-hmm. too much time on my hands type of things.
This was obviously text-based, right?
Text-based Wizardry, no, it had a 3D...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was first person, but...
Like Wargraph.
Yeah, it was first person,
right.
you walked through a maze, and you had multiple characters, and, like, spells, and the various character class type mm-hmm. things, and it actually had a, you know, had a goal. You had to go down and find the evil wizard and kill him, and there was all sorts of sub goals and stuff like that.
Did you do like any kind of strategy guides for it, or if you're doing a dungeon you would have to like map it out yourself?
You
and
had
like...
to map it out yourself.
Okay.
This is all
I think.
Speaking of Wizardry, is there a chance to do a Kickstarter of the OVA that came out
of people's
late?
Oh yeah.
Oh god. I'd be lying. I mean, you know, it has occurred to me to do that. You know, I've seen it. It's not that great.
Yeah. But it hasn't been a fellow Hawkwind, so you know, you not like it.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of... there's a lot of things like that that, you know, sort of, yeah, maybe one of these days, but I would be really amused if somebody else did it. I'll put it to you that way. I would definitely, if somebody else did a Kickstarter for that, I would back.
So if CPM was still around, that's something they should have already picked up by now and put out.
Who knows?
Do you pay attention to the Wizardry games that continue to come out in Japan? And do you find it ironic, if you have, that they have heavy anime themes at this point? They're aimed at the otaku market, and so you're playing Wizardry, except with, you know, full anime character designs. It's like it's come full circle over there for you.
I haven't really kept up with them. You know, it's like I got a lot of very strange Wizardry character goods that were done in Japan. The pen and pencil set was my personal favorite.
Oh, I didn't know they did that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The canned pen set. and it's actually... And they also did a keychain, which was kind of fun. I got into the beta for Wizardry Online when it came to the U.S.
Oh, wow.
I played it a little bit. Not really my cup of tea. The game I really got into was EVE Online.
I see. That's terrifying. Why aren't you ruling the anime industry with an iron fist if you're playing spreadsheets in space? Come on.
Well, I got elected to EVE's Council of Player Management for 4 years.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
Yeah. It turns out that one of the devs at CCP was a big Wizardry fan. And actually, his dev name is CCP Loctivite, which is one of the spell names of Wizardry. So. Mm-hmm. Stupid little piece of trivia.
That's close.
Yes.
So, you said you worked with CCP. Do you have any weird eccentric stories about working with John O'Donnell?
Yes, I do.
Do you want to share one of them?
No, I won't.
Not even talk about the Urusei Yatsura licenses.
Oh, that's
that's the more infamous
that's
one.
Known story. Basically, yeah. The way that worked was that the rights to Urusei Yatsura was split between two companies. Toho had Beautiful Dreamer, and what was the name? The actual company name, but the other company had everything else. So basically, we were living in Tokyo at the time. John was coming over all the time to do his licenses. So he went to he had this really great relationship with Toho. So he went over to Toho to get the license to Urusei Yatsura, Beautiful Dreamer, and then he figured, well, I'll go across town and complete the set. Meanwhile, we were already across town thinking exactly the same thing. So literally, we each licensed our respective parts, and then got on subway, and on opposite trains, went right across town, and found out the bad news. We ended up subtitling it for him to maintain the style. And if you've ever gotten the original box set that we did for the movies, we actually had an empty slot where you could put in their Beautiful Dreamer. That's a pity, because Beautiful Dreamer was the best in the film.
Yeah.
I had a school project on Mamoru Oshii for my contemporary art class, and I actually watched those first two films, and I really enjoyed the second one, and that was really the setup of how he became a director later on. Mm-hmm. So, and that one is more like it's really more character based. I can tell. That's more the easiest one to watch the UI universe than the first movie, because they throw in all these characters in the first movie that was why are you important? Yeah, you have to watch the TV series. Whereas the second one, they're kind of it's that core group, and it's them building themselves up and trying to get out of that situation.
Well, UI is just an amazingly good series. And the neat thing about UI was the TV series kept getting better every year. The best season was the last season.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know how they managed to do that, but they just kept making it better. And I really appreciated that, because when you get about 150 episodes into subtitling a TV series, if it's not getting better continually, it starts to become really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I wouldn't say no chance of hell.
Not at this point.
I would not be opposed to doing that if the stars aligned. It's just a matter of, there have been a lot of situations where something I didn't think I was going to be able to do, and then suddenly 5 years later, the right person gets promoted, and, the wrong person gets hit by a bus, and you get to be able to do something. So I won't say no to that. That would be a huge... That would be such a huge job to do, though, for re-release. Because, when we're doing these Blu-ray, new Blu-ray sets, I'm literally going over everything line by line, adjusting subtitle timing, one frame here or there to tweak it to make it better, and looking over the old dialogue editing kids. Jeez, we can do better than that. And I couldn't believe it. Some of our proofreading teams actually found a couple of mistakes where we've misinterpreted things in this, which we have checked over. We did our original VHS release. We rechecked and redid it for Laserdisc. We did the same thing for DVD and the Blu-ray release, and they actually found two or three lines where we've blown it and it's not noticed.
Still a good track record.
Well, yeah. We haven't had a sidekick wave yet.
I still stand by that attack.
I think it's actually a perfectly natural mistake to make, especially because they probably didn't have the original shooting strip. Mm. They were probably doing it from here. So what else we got, guys?
Well, another question, but is there any chance of Crusher Joe Blu-ray?
I would love to do Crusher Joe. I personally feel that Crusher Joe Last Weapon Ash would make an absolutely kick-ass live-action film. I mean, I was actually sort of reminded, I was watching, my wife and I went to Fury Road.
Best movie ever.
Okay. Well,
pretty great one.
I won't quite say that. I will say that I was seriously impressed by that film. Just in terms of the fact that it just never let up.
Exactly.
Movies in development hell for that long don't tend to come out that well.
And it actually did remind me of Last Weapon Ash, because in Last Weapon Ash, once the action gets going, it just never stops, and it just keeps ratcheting up, and something came together when they made that. Just the right people made the right decisions, the script got tightened up just right. I just love that. It remains one of the favorite things I've worked on. Not because it was particularly difficult to do, because it wasn't. I mean, because it was so good, it was just so easy to do. But, man, I was really pleased with how it came out.
If we're throwing out the wish list, Arcadia, my youth. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I know.
That also come with a vengeance of a space pirate dub.
Interesting. You like that film that much?
Yes. It's when I got back to animated,
can we know
that?
Oh, yeah. I still need to see that.
Yeah.
Do you? I was just going to ask. Do you look when you're? I know you're doing research right now, and you're starting to look into things like Kickstarters. Does it help if you're going, obviously I imagine it does. I don't know if you're going to say, I would like to release this on Blu-ray, but it doesn't have an HD master in Japan. I don't know how feasible it is for you to budget mastering something in HD if it doesn't already exist and you can't just license it.
It costs money, but you can...
But still.
One of the neat things about doing the Bubblegum Crisis Project was that I really developed like a spreadsheet of doom that lets me budget these things. And so the neat thing about it is that I can plug in, you know, how much is it going to cost to do a transfer and color correction, and, you know, what happens if there's a problem. The big risk factor there is that there's an unanticipated, you know, the quality of the 35 millimeter film they've got is an unanticipated problem. So that's a little bit concerning, but I don't think I'd let it stop me for something that I thought was really needful of a release. And it just means that, you know, you got to set the goal a little higher, probably like tack on $5 to the price. It's not a blocker. It's just the stuff that's already had a Blu-ray release is sort of lower hanging fruit,
right?
And it's one less risk factor. You know, it's less expensive. So it's just like one less thing to, like, you know, have a sleepless night over.
On the flip side, are you also looking at doing DVD-only releases for stuff that may have never had a U.S. release, if that's the option?
Yeah, I actually ran a poll a couple months back of people discussing that, because there are a bunch of, for example, older TV series that it just isn't either, it isn't practical to do an HD transfer, or they simply don't have the film anymore.
Right.
But that they still do have like a good quality, like a D2 master, so they could do a standard definition release. And that's definitely something that I think is perfectly viable. It's just a matter of finding the right title. Something that enough people would want, even though it was a standard definition release.
Was there any results from that favorable in terms of what you were kind of expecting or looking for in terms of what you
wanted
for the price range?
Actually, it was kind of interesting. The people who said, yeah, I would buy it on DVD, the average price that they were willing to pay on DVD was higher than I thought it would be. The people who said, I will only buy it on Blu-ray, are all a bunch of cheap bastards. And it's just like, oh yeah, I'll buy your 50-episode TV series for like $100. And I'm going, no, you won't. But I think that was probably... the people who are willing to take it on SD had perhaps a better appreciation and understanding of the economics, so that their answer was more, in a way, more thoughtful, and that's why they ended up saying, well, we would pay more than what I thought that they would pay. Which is really kind of an interesting result.
In my personal experience, I think what's likely to happen is that the market is shrinking for physical media to the point where the people who actually want to buy the fetish objects to have the disc are naturally going to be willing to pay more, because that's going to be the only option. You know, it's going to be streaming and then maybe a few physical releases, from boutique labels practically.
So what you're saying is that whatever I come up with, you know, blah, 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 the TV series, Fetish Object Edition, right?
At this point, when you have people who are just, I mean, it's so convenient to stream things, and it's wonderful. I like to hoard media, so I want to have a disc in the house. And it is practically the fetish object, where you're like, I could look at this on the internet for free all day long, or stream it in some capacity or whatnot, but I have the object, no one can take it away from me, I'm going to kowtow before it a little bit, you know.
It's, but also generally the media, too, is like,
and that's also
depression, you know.
That's certainly also true. I don't want to overstate it.
But do you feel like you personally own that item because it's a physical piece in your house that you can actually look at and touch at?
And fondle gently.
Well, that's up to you. That's your thing. But
family session.
Look, I really like
I understand where you're coming from to a certain extent.
I don't want to overstate it.
I'm not so sure that it's... There's the connection to the physical object, especially, like, I got to tell you, I love this keychain, and the reason I love it so much, apart from the fact that I use it every day, mine every day, is that it has this, it came out so much better than I thought it was, because it's got this marvelous, like, three-dimensionality, and I will literally find myself, you know, when I'm grabbing my keys and walking to the car, I'll be doing this.
A worry stone.
Yeah, exactly. And so I can understand the sort of possession of the physical object attribute to it, but I also think that there is a connection to the object or a connection to the event.
Sure. Really high-profile Kickstarters that are very successful, people get very excited about being a part of it and interacting with it and so forth. So I can totally see that.
Did you buy into Exploding Kittens?
I did not. I appreciated it from afar, and I dodged that particular bullet. But I've followed some Kickstarters.
Oh, I put my money in for that. Come on.
Oh, no. It was cool. But I've seen that the really successful ones, people get really into it, and you see the comment threads start exploding. They have a community around it, right?
Right.
And that's,
exactly.
That's the goal. So.
And that's actually one of the things I appreciated the most about doing this was the there was a little community that grew up around the project.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, one of the most fun things about doing it was writing the updates. I ended up doing like 50 updates.
Which was appreciated.
Yeah, but writing those updates and reading the responses to them was one of the most enjoyable. I mean, a lot of the other parts are it's work. I mean, it's fun work, you know, but it's stuff I've done before. But that was something I hadn't really done before, and so I really appreciated it. That sort of community aspect to it. But my question to you, and in fact to everybody, is how much of it is the physical object, and how much of it is the ability to be part of the community?
I'll say for myself, frankly, being part of the community is fun, and being part of this sort of the process is kind of entertaining. My end goal is to have a high quality release of a video at home. And so in terms of going, is my name on the project, am I backing the updated version where my name is part of the case, that was not me. I'm interested in having the best possible version of the film, having it sort of in my personal library. And it's sort of fun to go, oh, here's all the updates and whatnot, and chat with people and so forth. That was fun. But I don't know that that's my end goal personally. So.
Okay. Right. Anybody else got
that? That's a really good product. I mean, it's a nice little side perk.
I like that. Yeah, I'm like, hey, I've... Don't know if that's ever going to happen to me again.
and that's cool, and I see the appeal. It's just one that I wasn't looking for. I was looking for a poster, though, and I was glad I snagged one.
Posters are a bloody pain in the ass.
But if you have any more talking to video posters, now's the time to offload them.
No, I don't have any. Mr. Sonoda is going to do some new artwork for the set, and we're going to like have a folded poster type thing inside.
Nice.
He's also going to get the stretch goal. He's going to do a manga. And the neat thing, if you've seen the Japanese Otaku no video release, we're a little bit over, but nobody's kicking us out, so I'll just keep talking for as long. If you've seen the Japanese release, it has this little kind of mini manga that Sonoda did about Otaku no video. Sonoda is a really neat guy, and we've known him for like forever. So Natsumi called him up, and he's going to, if we meet the stretch goal, he's going to do a manga, like a four-page sort of mini manga story He's not quite sure what he's going to do now, but he may be the sort of working thing is to do a manga about his experiences with American otaku. Which could either be, you should either think that that's a really great idea or be quaking in your boots in fear.
Maybe a bit of both.
Yeah. But what he's going to do is he's going to basically, there's going to be, if we meet that stretch goal, there's going to be three new backer levels coming up where he will, like, take your photograph and biographical information and stuff like that and draw you into the manga.
That's terrible.
Probably wearing a hideously embarrassing cosplay outfit, but he will draw you into the manga.
I was really hoping with some of his women, female designs next to me, but...
Well, you could, you know, put your, you know, white girlfriend and whatever, send her picture in as a present.
I'll think about it.
he's promised that it, like, won't be worse than PG-13.
I think we have the next panel.
Are we getting kicked out?
I know the charity art.
Okay. All right, then. You know, I'll just wrap it up. If anybody's got one last question, I'll take it. Otherwise, we better get going.
Can we kickstart Macross 7?
What?
Macross 7.
Can we kickstart Macross 7?
That's not up to me.
What if you're just reminding the planet to do it as an empire or a business movie is?
I can't say anything other than it certainly has been discussed.
Okay.
And I will drop the hint that the title that we hope to be able to release next week, or at least announce next week, was at one point mentioned by somebody in this. So, go back to the tape, and you might be able to figure it out.
Hanzo the Razor.
Yeah, Hanzo the Razor, there you go. The 3D edition.
Oh, God.
All right, thanks, guys.
政治に噛みついた貫く十手のど根性